Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
Going Underground, The Intellectual Dark Web. Fraser Nelson. A good chunk of my home is lined with books from the Axelsson Jonsson Foundation. The print edition of this audiobook is typical of the species. Beautifully typeset, enlivened with gorgeous illustrations, and filled with the work of experts in various fields: religion, consciousness, war, culture. Their formula is to assemble the best writers they can. People of all kinds of political orientations, yet united by a love of vigorous but civil debate, an interest in viewpoints they disagree with, a willingness to go against the grain. But now, the writers in this book might ask themselves a question: are they part of the intellectual dark web? The phrase was invented as a joke by Eric Weinstein, an American mathematician and economist, to describe a movement that he witnessed and indeed was part of. It involved the fate of academics who declined to go along with certain campus fads, the use of new pronouns, for example, or demands that reading lists are changed to reflect ethnic and gender diversity. If they declined, they'd be the target of furious protests, cast as racist, transphobic, or worse. With their reputations damaged, in the eyes of terrified university authorities, their careers would stall and they would end up ostracized or losing their jobs. A few of them went online, with podcasts or YouTube, to continue the argument and found an audience of millions. This is not shock jockery, nor a kind of political porn. These are academics and thinkers holding debates that, for very modern reasons, it's now hard to hold on campus. There is no membership list of the dark web, no secret handshake, no system of joining, although in recent months, at the time of writing, quite a lot of people would quite like to do so. Even if the movement only lasts a short while, it can stand as a monument to the style of political debate in 2018. The cast: Eric Weinstein, of course, and his brother Brett, a biologist and evolutionary theorist. Both are Bernie Sanders supporters. Then Sam Harris, an outspoken Hillary Clinton voter, whose podcast now has a million listens a month. Not as many as the podcast of Ben Shapiro, an anti-Trump conservative. Then come the feminists, such as Christina Hoff Sommers and Camille Paglia. Perhaps most famously, there is Jordan Peterson, a Canadian psychology professor. And I'd certainly include here Douglas Murray, an associate editor of The Spectator and author of The Strange Death of Europe. They like to discuss all kinds of topics: religion and its place in society, economics, culture, changing social norms. This isn't unusual. Academics like to have such discussions. But perhaps most strangely of all, in the world of highbrow ideas and discussion, they enjoy vast popularity. Harris's YouTube channel has had more than 16 million views at the time of writing, greater than any writer of any broadsheet newspaper could hope for. But this looks pathetic compared to the YouTube views of Ben Shapiro, 23 million, and Jordan Peterson, 72 million. Dave Rubin, a political commentator and talk show host, has more than all of these put together, 179 million. The tone of their discussion is mild and gentle. Their pitch is not that they'll make you outraged for the sake of it, but that they'll offer thoughtful discussion that often goes way off the deep end, and that 60 or 90 minute long discussions with other public intellectuals are more fulfilling than the 10 minute debates offered by national TV and radio. And even the short mainstream media discussions tend to be Punch and Judy, with two people from opposing sides put together in the hope that they'll start tearing lumps out of each other. For those who want light rather than heat, the podcasts and YouTube lectures are a technological breakthrough. And then come the lectures. When my Spectator colleague, Murray, told me he was going to the O2 Arena in London to have a discussion with Peterson and Harris, I was intrigued at the idea of highbrow discussion in a 20,000 capacity arena and wanted to book tickets for my colleagues to go along, until I found out the cost. £160 a ticket. Sometimes popular thinkers like Thomas Piketty are referred to as pop star academics. But that phrase does not suit Peterson, because there are not many pop stars who can get away with charging £160 in venues with the capacity of a small town. Not since Billy Graham visited Wembley Stadium in 1954 have so many gathered to hear discussion, so there is no doubt that we're witnessing something extraordinary, perhaps unprecedented, in the realm of debate. But what? Those who read Peterson's book 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, will enjoy it, but it is not full of novel or unusual facts. He has been writing books for 20 years, and no one bought them in any numbers, but what has marked him out this time is his readiness to debate with his critics, rather than to cave in when faced with their accusations, and also his plain talking about what he is dealing with. I regard the made-up pronouns as neologisms of radical PC authoritarians who seek to exercise control of what other people say and think, he says. I'm not a fan of that sort of person, and I'm not going to be a mouthpiece for language that I detest. His fans will be people who wish they had thought of such eloquent put-downs. The books, podcasts, and YouTube debates in the intellectual dark web are of high quality, but not a quality or originality that you could not find on a television station. I mean no disrespect to these stylish, eloquent writers to say that they are not really the phenomenon. It's not about even what they are, but what they are a reaction to. They are saying fairly standard things at a time when doing so is seen to be inflammatory. To paraphrase Orwell, at a time of universal hysteria, stating the obvious becomes a revolutionary act. As a magazine editor, I've noticed this mood grow over 10 years. My first exposure to it was my first month in the job, September 2009. The Spectator was staging a discussion with some documentary makers who had made a film about HIV. In it, Luc Montagné, a Nobel laureate, says that a healthy immune system can shrug off the virus, and that in his opinion, many Africans are diagnosed as dying of AIDS when they are really dying of malnutrition. This film had been banned in certain places, which seemed an odd way of dealing with a controversial topic. So the Spectator assembled a panel of medical experts to put the claims to the test. I wrote a short blog about it. "That's rather brave of you, Fraser," said one of the commentators. "Be prepared to meet the AIDS denial community, who will be arriving on this blog post in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then the explosion. This was my first experience of a Twitter storm. Ben Goldacre, a pioneer in the art of whipping up a Twitter mob, alerted his followers to what he called AIDS denialism at the Spectator, and called for the event to be pulled. At the time, I didn't see what was serious about this. No one was denying AIDS at the Spectator or anywhere else. But as I discovered, the Twitter era meant that the accusation is enough. People didn't want to know more or ask what we were trying to do. Needless to say, Goldacre didn't want to come on the panel to try to argue with the filmmakers, He wanted the event cancelled. To offer them a platform, he argued, was to confer legitimacy to a repulsive pseudoscience. It was my first encounter with no platforming as a verb. We refused to pull out, but the digital mob went after other panelists and their employers, and they withdrew. There were other scientists sympathetic to the idea, but they explained that in their line of work, funding quickly dries up from anyone vaguely considered to be aiding or abetting AIDS denialism. The event had to be cancelled. We lost because we had been unprepared. This was, to me, entirely new and thoroughly sinister. Since then, Twitter storms have now claimed several victims. David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, had decided to interview Steve Bannon live on stage, taking the standard journalistic and liberal view that it's a good idea to probe and expose an opponent. But a revolt on Twitter, led by one of his own staffers, led him to pull out of the event just 12 hours after announcing it. Ian Buruma had to resign as editor of the New York Review of Books after a Twitter storm about his decision to commission an article from someone acquitted of a sexual offence. The same formula applies every time. A toxic allegation is made, AIDS denialism or normalising hate, a phrase applied to editors who publish opinions that some disagree with, then there is a pile-on, seeking to enlist enough high-profile people to create the impression of an irresistible force. Then the calls come. Sack the lecturer, or the columnist, or the cartoonist. An Australian caricaturist had to go into hiding after drawing Serena Williams and being accused of racism on Twitter by J.K. Rowling. The Twitter storm led to death threats against his wife and children. Not that the Harry Potter author will have intended this, but an accusation of racism from someone with 14 million Twitter followers can be enough to convict in the court of digital opinion. The historian Neil Ferguson has described the process well. As soon as you've had that experience, it's quite transformative, he wrote. You're taken aback to be on the receiving end of a social media mob, and to be attacked not for the actual substance of anything you have argued, but for being, covertly, a racist, an Islamophobe, a homophobe. I was always a believer in meritocracy and that we were engaged in rational debate. One made one's case, presented the evidence, and then the other side did the same. But here it's not the content of the article under discussion, but the personality of the author. The attacks are intended to blacken the name of the target. The era of instant outrage, easily transmitted on social media, means the other side are looking for enemies of the people and for heretics to denounce. And before I criticize university authorities for not standing up for free speech, I need to answer the question, why did I pull the AIDS event? Why didn't I continue with empty chairs for other panelists? The answer, I needed to pick my battles. Did I want to go into battle for a filmmaker about whom I knew almost nothing? Was I so sure that his argument held water? If The Spectator's name was going to be dragged through the mud for this, was it worth it? The answer to all of these questions is an obvious no. Such attacks work because everyone is mortified. I was a few weeks into the job, yet smeared as an AIDS denier. We had letters from people expressing disgust at opinions we'd never expressed. The mob works. It will target your boss, your boss's boss, and it often takes nerves of steel to carry on. In this way, Twitter, a medium actively used by perhaps 0.1% of the population, including a disproportionate number of the unhinged, sets the parameters of national debate. It manages to influence those who run universities, newspapers, and television shows. I'm struck by how many television producers check Twitter immediately after their shows have aired in lieu of an audience reaction. It is a tool that gives huge control to a vocal, often hysterical minority. In this way, the parameters of debate are narrowed. with effects that can be seen the world over. Like so many political phenomena, this one was summed up best by a Swedish academic. Henrik Oskarsson pointed out how the debate had narrowed so much that it had, in effect, created an opinion corridor, outside of which opinions were not respectable, and there were many widely held beliefs that were rarely expressed in public. That 40% of Swedes think that Sweden should accept fewer refugees, 60% want more animal rights, 50% don't agree that homosexual couples should be allowed to adopt children, 20% think there should be a death penalty for murder, and, my personal favourite, 25% of all Swedes want to increase the number of wolves. Sweden has an unusually large number of political parties, but if they all huddle together in this corridor, then they hand a vast amount of ground to new parties who will not be afraid to express such opinions, hence the rise of populism. The intellectual dark web is a highbrow expression of the same phenomenon. People wish to have discussions about all kinds of topics and can vote for new parties in order to widen this debate. The message of populists all over is a simple one. You are an ordinary person holding ordinary beliefs, and for this you are neglected, perhaps even despised, by an out-of-touch political elite who regard you as racist. So when populists are attacked as racists, they say their point is made for them. This is the feedback loop of populism. It extends, of course, far beyond Sweden. In America, for example, let's take a list of policies that were popular before Donald Trump was elected. Building a wall along the Mexican border drew the support of 39% of the US electorate. Repealing Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, was backed by 46% of voters. Bringing back torture for terror suspects, 64%. Banning all Syrian refugees, 51%. And a ban on Muslims entering the US, 51%. When Trump endorsed each of these proposals, he was attacked as a bigot, a racist, an Islamophobe, and worse. He revelled in the obloquy and sought more of it because, as he understood far better than his opponents, this is his greatest form of advertising, to be attacked for championing a popular opinion, which allows the feedback loop to set in. Look, he says to his supporters, this is what they think of you. It works because they rise to the bait every time. When the history of Trump's presidency is written, it may be seen not as the success of an extraordinary political entrepreneur, although he certainly is that, but an example of a politician created by his critics. He hogs the agenda because they talk about nothing else. He uses crude language to say things that most Americans perceive as common sense, then waits to be attacked. See, he says to his audience, look how crazy they are. See how they are wound up, consumed by anger. And they look down upon you as well as me. He has identified a certain shrillness in the debate and used it to power his own campaign. After attacking the upstarts, mainstream politicians tend to calm down, asking themselves if these populists are so vulgar, why are so many millions supporting them? Might they have a point somewhere? And might our political conversation have de-aligned with what our voters want? In Britain, this happened with Brexit, a traumatic political event. But it killed populism. The UK is, at the time of writing, the only large country in Europe not to have members of a populist party in Parliament. Brexit has tugged politicians back to the people, and the process is agonising for them. But it may well end up killing populism stone dead. In his classic definition, Princeton's Jan Werner Müller says that populism is not a political agenda, it's a rhetorical style, shrieking at those in power and the media as collusive, out-of-touch elites. Populists claim to speak for the people and often claim to be the only ones who can do so because other parties are illegitimate. The only thing that matters is the unification of the people, Trump once said, because the other people don't mean anything. Britain might have a far-left Labour Party, but the only politicians making such noises are, yet again, seen as cranks with no serious support. The intellectual dark web would not exist without the atmosphere that seems to have led basic conversations to be forbidden. Trump would not exist if more politicians had learned to debate immigration and culture without calling each other racist. A centre-left, centre-right duopoly tried to keep important issues off the agenda, but this can only work for so long in a democracy. Those who like broad-minded and wide-ranging discussion can choose the podcasts, YouTube channels, and websites that provide them. Voters who wish to change the political agenda can do so more forcefully by using coarse politicians only too willing to shake things up, and eventually things improve. A couple of months after the 2018 meeting in Engelsberg, Sweden had its general election. I listened to the final leaders' debate. We had the leader of the Christian Democrats denouncing honour repression of Muslim girls in Swedish homes. The Liberal Party leader was attacking hardline Islamist free schools. The Conservative leader, Ulf Kristersson, was taunting the Social Democrat Prime Minister, asking him which part of immigration he was most proud of. The unemployment? The gang crime? My Swedish wife, who was only half watching, looked up at that point and asked if this was Jimmy Åkesson, the leader of the populist Sweden Democrats. Åkesson expected to come first in that election. His party stayed in third place, having lost its monopoly on discussing immigration-related problems. This is the democratic process in action. The opinion corridor is widening, and it looks like the march of Swedish populists has been halted. Similarly, it will not be too long before universities start to stand up to the intolerance of a minority and defend people's right to disagree. The intellectual dark web will, most likely, be a flicker in history, a reminder of when the West's conversation was at its most shrill, and free-thinking people had to look to underground clubs for a place to air their thoughts. We should enjoy it while it lasts.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Bokförlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.